All right. Are we all set? All right. Thank you, Stephanie, our air traffic controller. Hi, Harold. My name is Scott Knox. I am 48 years old. Today is January 19th, 2023. I'm in Roxbury, Massachusetts, which is at the heart of Boston. So it's one of Boston's 16 plus neighborhoods. And I'm here with my one small step partner, Harold Lewis Senior.
That's okay. Yeah. Hey, greetings, brother Scott. My name is Harold D. Lewis Senior, and I am 61 years young. Today is January the 19th, 2023, and I'm in warm Sunshine State, Lakeland, Florida.
Ooh.
And I'm here with my one small step partner, Scott Knox.
Great. Harold, I have to say, I really like your frames.
Oh, thank you.
Stephanie, am I to read Harold's bio out loud? Okay. My name is Harold, and I am an African-American cisgender heterosexual male. I am a non-discriminating Christian. I'm originally from Greenwood, Mississippi, and now reside in Lakeland, Florida. I am married, 7 grown children, and 13 grandchildren. I love my country, but I am concerned about the political, economic, and racial divisions within our culture. I am currently serving as the Vice President of Biblical Diversity for an organization in Orlando, Florida.
Hello, I am a queer identifying champion for civic engagement and social equity. I'm not as left as many of my Boston-based progressive friends, family, and neighbors, but still veer very liberal. I'm an active and passionate home gardener, and I am also a beekeeper. I love reading, running, enjoying great food, and the opportunity to hear live music. A few of the biggest events that have shaped my life include losing my father and my first cousin to suicide 5 years apart and coming out.
So, Harold, it's great to be here with you. Why did you want to participate in One Small Step?
Yeah, thank you, Scott, for that question. Listen, I have and am in an organization and in a position that I do most of this kind of work all the time. Mm-hmm. And I get excited about meeting people from all walks of life, all categories and behaviors and experiences. And so when I came across StoryCorps and the opportunity to meet and engage someone different than me, I jumped on that opportunity as a curiosity person, just wanted to hear their story.
That's great.
Okay, Scott, why did you want to participate in the One Small Step?
Well, I think, you know, it's a lot of similarities with you, Harold. I think that one of the things I'm really concerned about is this growing divide amongst neighbors and fellow citizens. And, you know, whether it's, you know, pausing to read some of the comments on something that's published online in a, you know, in a news-based site, to just showing up at a community meeting and hearing how much kind of tension, and I think there's lots of things and lots of ways I could describe it, but I think at its core is like a lack of grace for one another and with one another. So I just found out about One Small Step this fall, and, you know, have been a longtime listener to my local NPR StoryCorps, 8:25 every Friday morning. Often, more times than not, it moves me to tears. And when I learned about this program, the opportunity to connect with someone who I'd never met, and kind of there'd be some engineering to have some differences, I was excited to participate.
Excellent. Yeah, so I've read your bio, and there was a lot of things that jumped out at me. All good. There was nothing negative. So let me just say that up front, you know. And again, I always enter and engage persons from a posture of curiosity. Mm. I love people, and I love learning from different people. So what was life like for you growing up, Scott?
Mm.
And are you a native Bostonian?
So, all right, that's a great place to start. So I'm a native masshole. And I am the third of the last four generations of my family to live in this Boston neighborhood of Roxbury. I didn't grow up here. I grew up right outside the city, about halfway between Boston and Cape Cod and a coastal town. And you know, the place I grew up was, I think, really fantastic in terms of the experience I had. And I lived in a place that had great public schools, and my parents enrolled me in the local elementary school, and it was kind of autopilot. You know, not that they weren't involved, but you know, there was confidence that I was going to be in schools that my teachers knew and cared about me and challenged me. And you know, we lived in a neighborhood where we didn't have keys to our house. And the joke was, if we literally, if we ever left the house for a weekend, that, and if someone was, I don't know, like feeding the cat, the joke was, don't lock the door because we don't have keys. And you know, that, I think that's changed. You know, it's just as the town has gotten bigger and the world's kind of changed. And and you know, my mother's still in the house that I grew up in, and so she'll be in 80 this September. So I think, you know, she now locks the door just out of for her own peace of mind.
Amen.
But I, you know, I think my experience was you know, in some ways similar to many people, in that, you know, my parents separated as a young age. So I went back and forth between my parents' house. My mom was my primary caregiver. I have an older sister who was very much like a second mom, 6 years older. And my mom worked full-time. She's actually still working full-time. She cleans houses. And she's like very hardworking woman. And I kind of bounced around between my neighbors' houses and whose people, whose houses and whose kitchens felt like my own. And, you know, the proverbial, it takes a village. I was really fortunate. And I think there's a lot of fingerprints on who I am as an adult.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and then I'm curious, Harold, just to kind of turn that around, growing up in Mississippi, what was that like? And tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Of course, we just come out of the celebration of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and growing up in Mississippi. And by the way, I just finished writing, I guess, chapter one of my autobiography. So about those experiences in Mississippi. But growing up in a segregated community that was divided and still divided by rivers and railroads, went to a segregated school from K through eighth grade. I had not been in a classroom with any other ethnicity or race other than people of color. So that kind of shaped my whole social orientation. I had grown up with six siblings and in a small community, as you said, it took a village. We had locks on our doors, but I don't know why, because anybody came there could come in whenever, because we opened the door, you know. But that was a great experience. If you live next to someone, Scott, you live next to me, whether we were related or not, you and my cousin, right? Mm-hmm. So we just grew up as relatives. And so that was that kind of a community I grew up in. And then matriculated through school. Again, in segregated schools until I went to high school. My high school had only been integrated like four or five years when I went there. So that was a total, out of the box experience for me. And I said it because, again, King had been assassinated. Malcolm X had been assassinated. Megar Ever, Emmett Till, all these different issues had been going on around me, and I had been hearing a lot of the different racial tensions and stuff. So now we get to talk before going to this integrated school, and the talk is, one, you don't talk to white women or white girls in your school. Go straight home. We had teams that we walked to school with and came back home with, you know, no one could veer off by themselves. And that was that kind of pressure that I felt like, you know, wait a minute, I'm still trying to understand all of this. But pouring into me, some of the pioneers of the civil rights movement was in my community, in and out, ongoing. So it kind of like by osmosis, that spirit jumped on me. And I became an advocate for civil rights, trying to understand, even to this day, I'm in this work, how and why people couldn't get along, you know, because of the pigmentation of the skins. And why were the houses on the north side of the railroads better than the houses on the south side of the railroad, right? I don't know if you ever heard the saying, you know, don't, you have to be home before the street lights come on. You know, that was kind of like a signal. Yes. And a lot of people think, you know, the curfew was because in Mississippi, they were kidnapping young African-American males and doing whatever they wanted to them. And so the street light was kind of that signal, get home before dark kind of thing, you know. And so that was kind of my social orientation. I had great coaches and mentors that poured inside of me about be the change that I want. And so I just grew up trying to advocate for that. And then in high school, I became the first African-American senior class president, right? Mm. It was integrated but segregated. Now imagine that. It was integrated but segregated. So when it came to homecoming courts, we had a white homecoming court and a black homecoming court. Except for sports, right? We only had one team. Of course, when it comes to athletics, right, somehow or another, segregation disappeared. Isn't that something? Yeah. Even
funny how that happens.
Yeah, funny how that. So I ran on the platform of demolishing this integrated but segregated kind of culture, right? And I caught a lot of flack for death threats, not from my classmates, but from the parents of my classmates.
Whoa.
From the parents of my classmates. So my mom wanted to take me out of this school and send me to a county school, which was all black school. And I said, no, you know, imagine being 16, 17, telling your grandmother and mother, no, I'm going to, you know, fight the power long now. You know? But nevertheless, it didn't happen while I was there. But 2 years after I graduated, they shifted and changed the culture. So that was kind of like, you know, the bedrock of my upbringing.
Thank you, Harold, for sharing that. There's so many questions I have, and there's one thing that is top of mind coming off of the celebration of Dr. King. You know, you mentioned, and when I just, if I do the math, you know, you were a young boy in 1968, and you know, my partner and I were talking about on Monday, just, you know, there are things happening around us at this, you know, in 2023 and the last several years that make, you know, makes it feel like things are a little bit more uncertain or tentative in terms of our connectivity and society. And then we were talking about what it must have felt like in 1968, you know, when Malcolm and Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy and others, just in short succession, were all assassinated. And you know, for as upside down as things feel today, I can't even imagine what that moment must have felt like. And I'm wondering if there's anything, and again, knowing you were a young person, but, you know, just what was that, anything that stands out from that time and how you remember feeling at that time?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we resonate every year. We resonate with, it's almost like, you can recall where you were and what you were doing emotionally when something of a crisis or a tragedy, like 9/11, for an example, right? I know where I was, what I was doing. So when Dr. King was assassinated, you know, I was 7 years old and was still trying to wrap my mind. He had come to, as a matter of fact, I just posted a picture of him walking, marching, he and Stokely Carmichael, down my street that I was born and raised on. I just posted it on my Facebook page the other day. And nevertheless, though, all that energy around change, voting rights, you know, Emmett Till had been assassinated at that time. Malcolm had been assassinated. Megan Evers had been assassinated. Jane Meredith had gone to Ole Miss. So all these things are, you know, it's just like, man, all this stuff going on around you. And as a seven-year-old, you're trying to process this. Now, mind you now, I had been incubated in a community. So anything outside of those boundaries, you know, I could not connect the dots. All I knew was there was this guy who was a preacher. And, you know, you had to be in church every Sunday, right? Had to be in Bible school every Wednesday. So all I knew, he was a preacher, right? And then my grandmother had to always authenticate for me what was going on, but still couldn't really process it as a 7-year-old, but all I knew was there was this giant, you know, coming to town, and all these people are marching, and we're going to them white folk neighborhood, could be dangerous, you know. And thinking that the march was like a parade, I want to be in it, you know how a kid is, because when you see all this going on, you want to be, but I was sheltered from it, so to speak. And then, you know, as I continue to grow and get into my earlier teen and adolescent age, and sharing some of the trainings, civil rights trainings, nonviolent workshops and stuff, I begin to wonder, wow, man, you know, why is it like this now? Now, let's fast forward through those decades, even up to today, because I'm always having this conversation is, one, Dr. King would be out of place today, right? He would have, if he was alive, God blessed him to be here, he would be out of place. He would serve his time. He would have given us what God had given him to give us. Now, what are we doing with what he gave us, right? And so it seems like we have stepped backwards. The division now is more eclectic. When it comes to LGBTQ, when it comes to race, when it comes to socioeconomics, I mean, I can go down a plethora of things that we thought the civil rights era was kind of healing. But somehow or another, each generation we dropped the ball. And then my question I always ask myself, what strategies, what do we do with the template that the King generation gave us, left us? What do we do with that template to add value to and move forward? So I struggle now with how much progress? I think Scott, when I say we move the needle shakes. It doesn't move. You know, I see the needle, it shakes. It doesn't. It just vibrates, right?
Yes.
And in any given day, it can move forward or backwards. So we're constantly having these conversations, which lends itself to the work that I do every day that I get to do as a diversity, equity, and inclusion vice president.
So, all right. So that's something I'm also curious to hear about.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say in that work that you're doing, it's within a faith-based structure. It's within a church, or is it? I'm curious to learn a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. Both. And okay. I came out of United Methodist Church after 31 years, and in that context, I simultaneously pastored and did D&I work. Okay. There's a saying in Mississippi is, you either born in the struggle, born during the struggle, or the struggle was born in you. So the struggle was kind of inherently born in me. And I ran from doing this work because I knew how, one, stressful and complicated it is and could be. I have to send, dogs and fire hoses and living in certain segregated communities. And the more I ran from it, the more I ran to it, right? And so I started being mentored in it. And it would just happen when I was ordained in the United Methodist Church that there was absolutely no kind of attention given to how do we work together. Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour, 11 o'clock in the United States. Now think about this, guy. Think about this. The church, for the most part, is one of the most open and welcoming, quote unquote, institution in the world. And yet we still decide to go to segregated communities. Right. Any given Sunday, we can wake up and say, okay, I'm going to go to a Presbyterian church, or I'm going to go to a Black Baptist church or a White Baptist church. But we still, what that needle moves us back to our comfort zones. So in the work that I do, when I say it's both and, it is a faith-based organization. But in order to impact the culture, we got to get out of our cocoons. And so my primary responsibility is tearing down walls, number one. And number two, in broadening the conversation from just race and gender to a more broader landscape, which include LGBTQ, AI, mental health, socioeconomics, ageism, disability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Wasn't there, I forget who said it, but didn't someone say the church choir was the original gay straight alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the musician. And I think out of ignorance, the church has, we probably have to talk again offline because I don't want to take up the lion's share, right? I ask pastors oftentimes, are there any gay people in your church, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, some of the, you know, right answers, if you will, would be no. I said, you want to know why there aren't any gay people in your church? And they asked me like, you know, why? Because you haven't invited them. Mm. You haven't invited them. Are there any people with disability in your church? No. You know why? You haven't invited them. Mm. You haven't invited them, you know? So when the workshops and the trainings that I do, in my bio, you read that I am a non-discriminating Christian, non-discriminating. And I am a multi-partiality advocate. I can hold space for anybody, mm-hmm. anywhere, from any experiences. Because I'm curious, man. I'm always curious, you know. I want to learn and grow and appreciate people for who they are as human beings.
I think one of the things I really appreciate about our match and our pair is that this is a glittering generality, but I, you know, as a gay man, especially as a gay man in New England, we have lots of ideas that are kind of reinforced about what a Southern faithful person may believe. And again, I know that is not universal, but it is something kind of like an archetype or a message that's like reinforced over and over. And you know, and I think that I also, you know, hear things when you add Black faith-based institutions is that it can be, you know, there's a preconceived idea that it can be harder to be out. And so I appreciate our conversation to kind of deconstruct some of those things, you know, because I think it's easy, even if I don't believe those things may just kind of live in the subconscious.
Yeah, amen. You know, when I was in kindergarten, going back to Mississippi, her name is Barbara Lynette Johnson. You know, at 5 years old, man, she was my Beyonce, right? We were in kindergarten. And she lives in Miami now, but let me give you the backstory. 5 years old, we were taking a nap, supposedly, as kindergarten. You know, it was nap time in kindergarten, right? Man, if I mention nap time to my grandkids now, they look at me like I'm from outer space or somewhere, you know? But nevertheless, Barbara was lying on the mat next to me. I mean, she had this most head full of pretty hair, very light skin, and I thought she was asleep. So, Scott, I raised up, went over and kissed her on the cheek, right? That was my first kiss.
Sneaky.
Look, so... we've been tricky, like we're like brothers and sisters to this day. I think I had gone to the military and come back home. And when I come back home, Barbara and I were always checking with each other. And she told me that she was coming out. I didn't know what that meant. Mm. What the hell is coming out? What that mean, you know? And then she said, hey, you know, I'm a lesbian. I was frozen. I didn't know what to say, how to say it, you know. And again, now the social orientation is from a Southern Baptist religious faith brother growing up in the church, you know, certain things were taboos, even though we had gay people in our church, right? I never heard a preacher demonized, put down, because they were either on the piano or in the choir, as you said, right? So to my own ignorance, no one had really educated me, and I just say first person singular, about these different behaviors. So when my best friend, the woman I thought I was gonna marry, man, she was my beyond. We talk about this every time we meet, right? Even though she has a partner, and I tell her partner, you stole my wife from me, right? And Barbara helped educate me. There's nothing on this planet I wouldn't do. I get kind of emotional now. Mm. That's my sister, man. Mm. Mm. I love that girl with everything about my being. And I have become an ambassador and an advocate for my sister. Mm. I don't get to choose who she loved, brother. All I know is I love her and who she loved. And here's what I said to her partner. I don't understand it all. That's my ignorance. And I don't impute that on anybody. As long as Barbara isn't crying or bleeding, you're my second best friend in the world. Because I love Barbara. Mm. And she's... Hurricane coming. She tell me and get the hell out of Lakeland, come to Miami. Hurricane come to Miami. I tell her get the hell out of Miami, come to Lakeland. That's how tight to this day that we are. And when they show up as a couple, it's not about two women showing up. You know, it's about my best friend showing up that I'm willing to die for. And so I become an advocate for that, even in my workshops and my trainings. I'm tactful and savvy how I engage the conversations, because it's still a hot button issue for a lot of persons, you know, that I even work with. Mm-hmm. But again, I always use Barbara's story. Cause that's my, her mother even called me. We got to do something about Barbara. What you want me to do? Listen, I love my sister, you know. If she's in love and she's happy, I'm ecstatic. I'm ecstatic, you know.
And that's storytelling, you know, that relationship, that experience, and that storytelling is, I mean, that's I think the most meaningful, right? You know, in engaging in these conversations, because, you know, chances are we, you know, there's someone that we can all think of like that.
Yep.
Or many of us can think of like that.
Yeah. So, you know, even when I read, and I didn't even know, matter of fact, I just read your bio this morning, so I didn't even know. And there were several things that struck me, one being a queer-identifying champion, which suggested to me that you were an activist in that circle, number one. And then number two, then I asked myself, you know, what was it like for you in coming out? What were some of the fears? What were some of the hesitations and experiences once you came out?
Well, thank you for that. Well, you know, a couple of things. I will say that, you know, when I won the birth lottery in some ways, you know, I was born into a town with good public schools and a safe community, you know, with the body and skin that I have that, you know, has allowed me to kind of pass and move through life in certain ways. And to be surrounded by, you know, people who love me. So I think, you know, there was so much privilege and so many gifts that I have had. I think that, you know, and I even think my queer identity is a gift now as an adult, but as a young person, it felt like a real yoke. It felt really, it was something that, you know, gave me depression, you know, that motivated me to overcompensate in, you know, other ways. You know, I think there's an archetype for certain gay men, and I imagine this is inclusive of queer women too, called the perfect little boy. And you have to, you know, you're simultaneously like moving throughout the world to kind of do everything you can to keep someone from asking, do you have a girlfriend or are you dating? Because you're putting yourself out in the way in the world to kind of, you know, excel at other things, or to always lead with the curiosity, not to be the, you know, the primary speaker. And when I came out, you know, it was a series of steps of coming out. And I think that I was in my mid-20s when I had the big conversation with my mom. In my mind, that was the real coming out. But there was lots of things leading up to that point where I when I look back on it, I think of them as the sunset conversations. So Harold, if you were one of my besties, you know, I'd reach out to you, and I probably had a dozen of these, you know, basically, you know, can we talk? And you know, each time I had one of those, it was like gearing up, you know, to have this, you know, to take this huge rock off of your shoulders. So after 12 of those, I felt like I'm exhausted. I'm kind of exhausted. And each conversation was a gift. You know, I couldn't have asked for a better reception. You know, from my childhood best friend, Brad Chelsea, who, you know, responded, this doesn't change anything. And in fact, I have more respect for you now than I did, you know, 10 minutes ago.
Amen.
So, you know, and it chokes me up thinking about how generous people were. But then I got to a point where I'm like, I'm exhausted with these sunset conversations. So I was training for a race, and I came off of running several miles. It was just like filled with all these endorphins. And I was like, fuck it. Excuse my language. I'm going to send an email. Sorry, Stephanie. I'm going to send an email to everyone I know, you know, who I want to know. Press send. People, you know, were great. You know, it's funny, even though it's like 20 years ago, I don't think I've gotten this choked up talking about it in a while. But, you know, what I'm moved by is the grace that people have given me. And then I think of, you know, I came up to my mom, she was great too. And it was kind of a funny story where I was, my appendix had burst. And I was feeling sick all weekend, went to work on Monday. I'm like, oh God, I really don't feel well. And, a coworker came over. I kind of described how I was feeling. And she's like, my husband's appendix just burst. This sounds just like that.
Oh, wow.
I'm calling, you know, we're getting you to the hospital right now. So I get to the hospital, you know, it turns out that my appendix is burst and I have to go right into surgery. And so, you know, I called two people, my mother, let her know I'm going to the hospital. Like, I'm going to have surgery. I'm getting fine. This is where I'm at. And then call the guy I was dating. I'm sorry, Harold.
You okay?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so called the guy I was dating. I get wheeled out of surgery. You know, everything goes fine. I get wheeled out of surgery, and the first person I see is this guy I've been dating. But everyone is my family is met as my good friend. You know, they know him as, you know, my good friend. And I see my mom. And I'm a little loopy on just all the drugs, you know, post-surgery. And, you know, I remember being in the hospital room and thinking, you know, like, Michael's going to want to be, you know, he's going to want to be like supportive and nurturing, but he knows he can't. And so I, you know, it was kind of this dramatic after school special moment where, like, I gestured to my mom, like, you know, hey, can you ask everyone to leave the room? So, you know, she clears out, and, you know, I tell her, like, mom, you know, just so you know, Michael's my partner. And she didn't get it. She's like, wait, I thought you worked in nonprofits. Are you starting, you know, you're starting a business? No. And it was like, you know, it was so funny at the time, but, you know, it just shows, like, I couldn't even say I'm gay. You know, I could say who I loved, but I couldn't. So then, you know, I think, you know, this was in 2003. And, you know, for a certain generation of people, you know, my mom being one of it, she gets this big memo. She's looking down at her son in the hospital, and all of a sudden she got really concerned that really what I was in the hospital for was something else, and that I had HIV. And, you know, we quickly, you know, addressed him, like, that is not that. It's true. My appendix did burst. That's the only reason I'm doing it. I don't have HIV. And she, you know, we talked for a little bit more, and then, you know, I asked her to bring folks back in. And so Mike was the first person to come back in. And I told him, like, oh, I just came out. And he was like, what? Oh my God. You know, like, that was like, I'm totally unprepared for this. You know, he didn't say all this because it was just a rehab, but I could see it on his face of, like,
right.
And now, like, how I'm showing up has just dramatically shifted. You know, how I engage with my mother, like, I'm looking at her eyes, looking at me, wondering what she's. And, you know, I think, again, there was, you know, I think there was, for my mom, you know, she, 2 weeks later, we were together, and I asked her, is there anything you want to talk about, or you're curious about, or you want to, you know, ask about? And she, She's like, oh, you know your mom. Like, I'm cool with everything. And I'm like, well, yeah, I know that. But she was still on her journey. And she's like, well, I guess, I do have a question. Like, when did you decide this? It was her frame, her framework, her experience, her ideas were that, this was something I had decided. And I'm like, mom, do you think if I had a decision that I would have chosen what is at that time, like a harder path, And she's like, well, some of my friends who are gay or lesbians, they were married and then they decided that they were gay or lesbian and they were in bad marriages. And then they decided they'd be gay or lesbian. I'm like, well, let's change that. that marriage may not have been great because they weren't able to be who they were.
Wow.
So that was like 2002, 2003, 2023. I just got engaged to my partner. We're getting married next year.
Congratulations. All right. Congratulations. Thank you.
And she has, again, so many I've been very fortunate because not everyone has had my experience. And I get to show up in the world, within my family and in the greater world. I can hold my hands with my partner. I can talk about this idea, this step that we're taking together. And it's celebrated in the same way that, my sister was when she married a man. And, I'm fortunate that I have a, mother who every voicemail that she leaves, she ends it with, I love you both.
Amen. Amen.
So,
amen.
I think that, again, I've had a really, my experience is obviously my own. It's not unique. And I'm very mindful of hearing my friends' stories who, whether it was, they grew up in a different part of the country or a different family or a different community that wasn't that accepting. And I think now to be a queer person is a real gift. And, I think it's a whole other conversation of why I think it is. But I get to, we've made the choice not to have children. And I get to show up with my partner as, someone who has an amount and a bucket of love that we can give out, beyond just the two of us. That feels, very special and at times like my family has needed. That's a little bit about my coming out story. Or a lot about my coming out story.
Wow. Yeah, listen, that story is very powerful and a gift. So thank you for sharing that. I want to encourage you to keep sharing it and the courage that comes with it. I think liberates others out of ignorance, because I discover most of the time. I do a workshop called A Seat at the Table, right? And we have 10 chairs at the table. One of those chairs has always got to be empty, always. So if you're at the table, you look around the table, I ask you one question, who's not at the table? Who's missing? Who's missing from the table? I don't speak now. He is in the spirit that I'm about to say. I don't speak for LGBT community. I advocate for their humanity. I advocate for the love of who they are. But I invite a person from that community to speak for themselves.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I invite a person. Scott can say this better than me, not me, right? I'm going to stand by him. Now, what I am a bully buster. That's what I am. Yep. I am an implicit bias police. That's what I am. I'm a microaggression manager. That's what I am.
Yeah.
So if something comes out twisted or sideways, I'm the first one to speak up. So, no, we don't talk like that. No. Scott's my brother. He's welcome here. He's respected here. I value him. He's taught me so much. That's who I am. And you know what the ongoing conversation is? Man, you can't say nothing about that dude around Harold, man. Harold.
You know, I have to say, Harold, I think that like even in this short conversation, and even though we're not sitting across from each other, I'm usually more of a I don't want to say like I repress my feelings, but I don't necessarily put them out in the way. And I think this I'm picking up a vibe just in this short connection that allowed me to kind of you held space for me to be a little bit more open. And I really appreciate that. That translates over my computer screen.
Thank you. And I appreciate you saying that because I work on this every day and I try to my children and grandchildren as well. I try to share with them what my mom and grandmother didn't have. They just didn't have the intellectual technology to share that and pass that down to me. And so in this space that I operate in, we value people. You ever heard the old cliche? You can tell I struggle with it. It says, treat people the way you want to be treated.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I don't subscribe to that. I subscribe to this one. So my book is coming out. This is a commercial. Right? I got a book of Luology coming out. My last name is Lewis, right? So the book of Luology. I have 1,099 books coming out. But one of them says, don't treat people the way they treat you. Treat them the way God treats you. Treat people the way God treats you. Scott, God doesn't see me any different than he sees you, brother. God doesn't love me any different than he loves you, brother, or less.
Yes.
He doesn't. He doesn't.
I fully believe that. I feel that radical compassion, you know, that I keep using the word grace, but I think that is. And the more we can aspire to that. With one another.
Yes. And I think what negates the ignorance and most times stupidity is conversations like this.
I agree.
It's conversations. Listen, and sharing and connect. I've connected to you, by the way, too. Vibe, spiritual. Because as a matter of fact, I said, if I was in Boston, I would race you for that hat you have on your head, you know?
I figured, well, between the sweater and the hat, I had to show up a little Boston.
Now, I shared this with Stephanie because I'm being in Lakeland. She's in Minnesota. Don't invite me to Boston, you know, before June, Doc.
No. I already like you too much.
Look, I promised my wife that I would take her to Martha's Vineyard to Nantucket. And she's still waiting on that, you know. I love traveling. I love meeting people, man. I love engaging people. I've yet to meet a stranger, man. I engage people for who they are and how they add value, as you've done for me today in this conversation. And I would cherish this moment, man, for the rest. And can't wait to get the audio to share with some of my colleagues because I do this work. I love. There's a saying, another Luology, we don't choose our callings, our calling chooses us.
Yes.
I'm so glad that now I'm praying that what I'm about to say is a truth, that you feel liberated, that you don't have to wear a mask, that you don't have to carry this burden of discretion and discreet. There was a game show out years ago, with a real Scott Knox stand up, you know? Not that imposter, right?
Right.
Not that imposter. So just do you, man. Be who you are. I think we rob the world. No, we rob the universe of the gift God downloads in us when we try to be who and what we're not. You're a gift, man. You're a gift to humanity. You're a gift. So I want to encourage you and challenge you to keep pressing forward. In your activism and just who you are as a person. Yeah. I don't see you as a queer person. I don't see you as an Anglo person, nor a Bostonian. I see you as another light-skinned brother, man, that I've met in a virtual space.
Thank you for that, Harold.
Labels and identifiers. So anyway, you take up the last 5 minutes, brother, because you don't got me. Why you don't pull the trigger in me?
All right, well, I want to pick up something in our last couple minutes. Yeah, you mentioned you should absolutely take your wife, bring her to Martha's Vineyard. I mean, Nantucket's nice, but Martha's Vineyard is beautiful. And
okay,
because I assume you love your wife, don't come before June, right?
Right.
So what, you know, I'm curious because I love to travel. What's one of your favorite travel experiences that you've had?
Well, it's a tie between Zimbabwe and Victoria Falls and Dubai.
Wow.
It's a tie. Yeah, man. I don't know if you've ever been to either one of those.
I have not.
And I tell my wife all the time, if I wasn't married to her, I probably wouldn't have come back. You know? I love Abu Dhabi, man. Dubai, listen. You know, being an Arabic nation, though they have some restrictions on a whole lot of things, but I think they're loosening up a little bit because the tourism is just flooding into that country. And so there's a population boom going on over there. And then in Zimbabwe, Victoria Falls, and I love Niagara Falls. I've been there. We've been there several times. As a matter of fact, I was about to make an exodus to Canada if we don't get our act together in America. But
you and me both.
Zimbabwe, Victoria Falls, brother, Harare. Oh my God. Yeah. Mm. So yeah. So I've been all over the world. I was supposed to be in India this month, but they've shut down because of some COVID issues that they were having. I was going to a major conference over there for about 15 days. We travel all over the place.
I was gonna say it sounds like it.
We travel all over the place. All over the place. And what I do before we travel is go to the embassy and get all of the non-tourist sites. I said, man, I don't want to go where the tourists go because I know y'all robbing us, right? And I asked, so if you had a friend, like, for example, when I went to Zimbabwe, Harare, the capital, right? If you had a friend, who should I look up? And this guy's brother was the deputy on the police force that picked me up at the airport. And I had a ball.
That's a good local connect.
Yeah. Dubai and Zimbabwe, they are tied.
Oh, that's great.
Yep.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you? You travel, get outside of Massachusetts?
I love Massachusetts. I love New England, but I love to travel. And I would say two of the best kind of on that international theme. I had a friend who was living in with her husband in Nairobi for a couple of years. And she was working for Peace Corps. And I got to go with the two of them to Zanzibar. And such a beautiful island, to experience a predominantly Muslim society. Absolutely phenomenal. And that could be like a whole other hour of our conversation.
Because I was offered a professorship at Nairobi University.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are you still considering it?
Well, listen, that's another story. Prior to coming here, I had gotten offered a position there. And then this position came open. And a friend of mine told me about this position, not knowing my wife was in the other room praying that we didn't go. So she must have more credit with God than I do, right? Because I'm in Orlando now. Listen, Scott, man, this has been a blessing. It's been a gift. So many takeaways on so many levels, brother. I just can't begin to describe and define what I'm feeling now, the energy that I'm feeling. I've been on tiptoe anticipation for this moment. And it is more than what I expected, brother. Just engaging you, hearing your story in this short frame has been a blessing to me.
Thank you, Harold. I co-sign that. It feels such a gift. And I had kind of nervous anxiety anticipating, you know, what was it going to feel like to meet someone brand new in this kind of slightly engineered format? And I'm grateful for one small step. I'm grateful for your time. And look me up on Facebook if you and your wife make it up to Boston. I'll be your local host.
Amen. Listen, I saw in your bio too that you like certain foods. So if you go on my Facebook profile, you've heard the Master Chef, Chef Ramsay?
Oh, yeah.
I'm the Pastor Chef. He's the Master Chef. I'm the Pastor Chef.
All right, I'm right.
So I have a cooking show called Pastor Can Cook.
I'm going to look it up.
Yeah. Anytime. I know we're out of time. You know, that's what happens when you get two loquacious persons, Stephanie, on one of these calls, right?
That's right. It's been great.
So excellent.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harold, very much.